Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another installment of FlyAnglersOnline.com podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Hugo Gibson, and this week I have a very special guest. Not only is he a world-famous fly tier, he's also an author, and among his many, many accomplishments, one that he's probably not very well known for, but in my opinion is my favorite, he's actually a member of FlyAnglersOnline.com. How are you doing today, AK?
Good, just fine, thank you.
So, how did you get your start in fly fishing? Where did it all begin?
It all began when I moved to Michigan to accept a new teaching job as a band director. And there were a lot of little brook trout streams up there. And being a teacher, I couldn't afford to buy flies, so I taught myself how to tie them. And I bought a couple of brooks, but the flies in the brooks didn't look like anything that I saw on the stream. And that's what set me off to where I am now.
That was actually my next question was, how soon did you get into the realm of tying flies in the fly fishing world?
About a year after we moved to Michigan, somebody saw my fly box and said, God, you ought to sell those. And I thought, huh. So I tied up the selection, and every time I went fishing, I'd stop at a fly shop, and I'd go in and see what they didn't have, and I'd walk in with my selection and say, well, you don't have any of these. Would you like to buy some? What's he going to say? No?
True.
And that's basically how I got started.
Okay. How quickly did your business grow? I mean, was it something that you just kind of dabbled in a little bit, but you kept on teaching, or did you realize that you could make a pretty decent living tying flies and decide to go tie flies full-time and stop teaching?
Well, it's kind of a long, involved story. I tied flies for a few shops in Michigan, and one year I took a trip to West Yellowstone with a dear old friend of mine and met some people from Boulder who belonged to the TU chapter here, and one of them was the owner of a fly shop. And I was talking to him. I said, well, someday when I retire, I'd like to move to Boulder and work in your shop. He said, that'd be just fine. You can tie flies for us, too. In fact, I'll send you an order. You can work on it this winter. And the following summer, I came out to Boulder and worked in the fly shop and tied flies. But I was still teaching, and it was a good... That summer in Colorado was a good stress management seminar for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go back in the fall and teach for another year, and then go back out Colorado and work in the shop. And then one day the owner called and said, well, I've got good news and bad news. I said, well, let's hear the bad news. I just quit my job. He said, well, the bad news is I sold the store. And I said, well, what am I going to do this summer? And he said, well, the good news is the guy who bought it wants you to come manage it. That's how we got to Boulder.
Okay.
And then the fly tying really took off.
So now do you just tie at home, don't you? You don't tie for the shop anymore.
Well, I tie for one shop, yeah.
Okay.
It's Mike Clark's Bamboo Rod Shop in Lyons, Colorado.
Oh, okay.
And I have trouble keeping up with him.
I bet. Now, I think all of us who tie flies have dabbled a little bit in trying to invent something new. Walk us through your discovery process, kind of what makes you tick when it comes to trying something new. Or, you know, if you see a bug on the water and you look at how the fly is riding on the water, what makes you go, what if I do this or what if I do that?
I always carry a little aquarium at my vest. And one of my epiphanies was John Gearock and I were down fishing the South Platte River here in Colorado, during the famous blueing olive hatch. And we weren't catching as many fish as we thought we should. Fish would come up and look at the fly and then refuse it. And so I would catch the insect and look at it, and all of a sudden I noticed mayfly bodies are not fuzzy. Yet all the blooming olives you could buy any place and all the patterns were using dubbed bodies. And a lot of them said, we use this dubbing because it's translucent. Well, mayfly bodies are not translucent. They're shiny. So there's a misinterpretation of this definition of the term shiny and translucent. Translucent means light passing through, but the bodies of all mayflies are a little waxy and light reflective, and that put me on the idea of using stripped and dyed rooster hackle quills for the bodies of the mayflies, and I tie all my mayfly now with stripped and dyed quill bodies or wild turkey biot bodies. The only fly tied with a dub body anymore is an Adams, and that's more out of tradition than anything.
Well, that's certainly a different way of looking at things.
Well, the thing is, in fly tying, there's been so many changes in the from one of the major growers, and one of those saddle hackle feathers will tie at least 8 flies. 10 years ago, if you saw something like that, you'd have a heart attack. So the new materials that are available now have changed a lot of the rules in how you handle it. I say in some of my seminars that we have our rules for how to tie flies, but then you have to deal with the rules of the material you're using. Each material has its own set of rules, and you have to learn what those are.
Another question for you. When it comes to fishing, it's pretty well known that you fish with bamboo almost exclusively. What is it to you that makes bamboo speak to you like a fishing rod should?
The first bamboo rod I ever bought was from a sporting goods store that was going out of business, and it was the Head and President, which turns out is a very collectible rod now. And when I first took it out of the tube, I loved the smell of the old varnish. When you take a graphite rod out of the tube, you don't smell anything.
Nope.
Except chemicals. And I soon learned that when fishing bamboo, and I own some graphite rods, don't misunderstand, and I'll use them if I have to. But bamboo does most of the work. You don't have to do much except start it and stop it. There's just a pure joy of fishing bamboo rods. In fact, I was up in Rocky Mountain Park yesterday with a new friend, showing him a little place I like to fish, and I'm using a 7-foot, 10-inch bamboo rod, and the line for five weight, the line just seems to defy gravity. I mean, you lift it up, make a back cast, and one forward cast, and fly goes back where you're looking. And it's a very gentle way to fly fish, I think.
I have to agree. I've only used a bamboo rod once. My dad has got an old Head that he bought at an antique store. I put it together for a day, and oh my gosh, I don't know how to put it into words, but it just, I mean,
it's magic.
It is. It really is. There's just something about it that it's, I don't know, I think it becomes more a part of you than a graphite rod would for some.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've got some.
It's hard to describe the pleasure of fishing bamboo over graphite. I've heard graphite rod manufacturers say, well, it has the same action as a bamboo. And no, it doesn't. There's only one graphite rod I've ever cast that fishes like a bamboo, and it's called the Heritage Rod. A dear old friend of mine who owns a company called Castle Arms has these rods made in Korea, and they're very affordable. And when I have to fly someplace, I'll take his graphite rods because I won't fly with bamboo anymore. So I've been through his rods. That covers most of the kind of fishing I do if I have to fly someplace. But if I'm driving, I put Keen in my truck.
I've got a little 3-weight. It's a 7.5-foot. It might be an 8-foot 3-weight that a friend of mine made for me in Scotland and sent it over. And it's very, very soft. It's about as close to that bamboo experience that I had that I've ever come with a graphite rod. And it's a fun rod to fish with, but it just, like you said, it's tough to compare the two. There's a night and day difference.
Yeah.
So, what's your most memorable fish?
I think the most memorable fish was the biggest brown trout I ever caught when I lived in Michigan.
Uh-huh.
I was fishing with a dear old friend who's since passed away, and we were fishing on the Thunder Bay River in Michigan. And we came to an old railroad crossing from the leftover from the logging days. And what it did was squeeze the stream together, and it was very deep in there. And I tied on a grizzly streamer and put 3 piece-size split shot on, dropped it in, and then lifted the rod, let the current take the streamer down in, and then did a hand retrieve on the way back, and all of a sudden it stopped. And I had this 22-inch bob trout on, and I finally landed it. And my friend said, well, of course you're going to release it. And the way he said it, there was no question I was going to have to release it.
Yeah.
It was the biggest trout I'd ever caught in my life, and I turned it loose. And it was a wonderful feeling. I think that's the most memorable trout I've caught bigger fish since.
Uh-huh.
I've caught fish that ran farther, jumped higher. But that one was, that one changed my life.
How when you say it changed your life, how so?
I can't remember the last time I killed a trout.
Oh, wow.
And I love to eat fresh trout, but I have a hard time doing it. Because of that experience and because so many more people are fishing, there's a lot of pressure on the resource, and I just think it's a good thing to put them back so I can enjoy it again, or maybe someone else can enjoy it again.
Right. Well, Oh, I agree with you there. I keep a few every once in a while to eat, but, you know, most...
Oh, they're good.
Oh, they are.
There's nothing better than a half a dozen 8-inch brookies in a frying pan.
The tastiest trout meal I ever had, I was fishing in the Snowy Mountains just outside of Laramie, Wyoming, and it was a tiny little stream. I wish I could remember the name of it, but I caught a handful of those little brookies like that, and oh, I just fried them in butter.
Yep,
oh, my
you
word, you couldn't have beat it with a 10-weight.
Nope.
It was just amazing.
Half a dozen brookies and a little good scotch on the rocks.
Yes.
Life is good.
I agree. So speaking of fishing and memorable fish, a lot of people associate you with John Gearark. How did you and John ever hook up and become friends?
Excuse me. When I was coming out to Boulder in the summer to work at the fly shop, an old friend of mine that I knew from my Michigan days had moved out here. He was living in Denver at the time, and he said, I know a guy in Lyons I think you'd like to hook up with. And he gave me his number, and I gave him a call, and we went fishing together, and it was like we've been doing it for 100 years. We had all the same outlooks about a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Whether it was politics or jazz or rock and roll or trout fishing or flies or whatever. We it was a marriage, sort of.
It's rare to find a friendship like that so quickly.
Yeah.
But boy, is it nice.
Well, that's the great that we knew so much about each other that we didn't dare become enemies.
That's a good line. I might have to remember that one. Of all the rivers that you've fished, what are some of your favorites, and why?
My favorite Colorado stream is the Frying Pan River, and I like that because there's a hatch on that stream every day of the year, mm-hmm. whether it's wintertime or dead hot summer. There's something hatching sometime during the day, and when I go there, I don't take my nets. There's usually dry fly action. But Colorado, that would be my favorite. I have another place I like to go up in Rocky Mountain Park, and I will not name that stream.
I won't ask you to.
Pretty popular place. My favorite out of the country stream is up in Labrador,
mm-hmm.
Where the brook trout get huge. And my favorite stream in the nation, I'd have to say, is the Henry's Fork. And I like that one because it's so damn technical. It's either feast or famine up there. On a good day, you think you're really good. On a bad day, you know how bad you are.
I've had a few days like that up here. Jeez. Oh, I went down to a friend of mine from Florida, who I know through Fly Anglers Online, came up to Washington a couple of weeks ago, and we went down to Rock Creek just outside of Missoula. I live in Havre, Montana, which is north central.
Uh-huh.
And when we got there, the stream looked good, but it rained that night, and every day, all day and all night, that whole trip, so the water was just blowing out like can be, but the salmon flies were hatching.
Oh, boy.
And there were a few people who were fishing, and a few of them caught fish, but I couldn't buy a bite. I mean, it just, there was none of us, we fished hard all 3 days we were there and didn't catch a thing, and it was pretty humbling considering how good, or I don't know that it's good, but how easy the fishing up here is.
Well, the salmon fly hatch occurs at a time of the year where the fish can either see them or they can't. And a friend of mine and I were fishing the Madison River back in, I'll never forget this year, 1976. It was a low water year, and you can actually wade the Madison River. And his name is Coke Winter. John's written about him.
Mm-hmm.
He and I floated that in his little duck boat, and I couldn't believe how big brown trout could get.
Yeah.
And they were on the surface eating those giant Paranarsis. Most fishermen, when they fish a salmon fly hatch, fish a fly that's too small. Those mantles are over 2 inches long.
Oh, they're huge.
Yeah. And there are more glasses ripped off into the stream during that because the things will land on your neck. And people are trying to wipe them off and tear their glasses off.
I honestly was shocked when I saw how big that salmon fly was. The first one that I saw, it came tootling along and landed just a few feet to my right. And I thought, what the heck is that? No way. It's a salmon fly. I mean, it had to be every bit of 3.5 inches long.
Oh, yeah, they're huge. I tie mine on a number 2 streamer hook.
Yeah. I looked at what I had available, and I thought, well, this is just an exercise in futility. There's no way that this is going to fool them. I mean, it was not even close to the size of the
most people fish a fly that's about half the size of the natural. And part of that is because they're fishing a light rod, and they can't cast anything bigger.
I had my 4-weight, and it would have been a struggle to cast something as big as that thing was. Good grief.
When I go for the salmon fly hatch, I take a 9-foot 8-weight with a reel that's got about 300 yards of backing. And 1 year, I had a trout on the Madison take me down to the spool. I had to break him off. 300 yards downstream.
Oh, my gosh.
That was huge.
I can't
even imagine. My friend was sitting on the bank. He saw it. He said, break it off. You'll never land it. It's a 3-footer.
Unreal.
Just a big old
I had a fight like that with a salmon on the Pierre Marquette in Michigan. I used to live in Michigan as well, and it, holy smokes, man. It was heartbreaking to lose that fish, but...
Yep. Most of the ones you remember.
Yep. And believe it or not, some of my most memorable fish are some of the smaller ones I caught, but it's just the day, the scenery, everything that comes together. So, well, I won't keep you too much longer. For people getting into tying flies, what beginner's advice would you give them?
Take lessons. Go to your local fly shop and inquire about taking fly tying lessons. You'll learn more in 4 lessons than you'll learn in 4 years trying to do it yourself.
When I started fly fishing, it was, oh, good grief, 23 or 4 years ago, and there just wasn't anything out there at that time that I could get my hands on. It is. I will agree. It's very valuable to even just, you know, take a lesson from somebody who ties flies. It doesn't have to be a fly shop. But.
Well, the second bit of advice I would give to anybody who wants to get into it is to not buy a fly tying kit. A lot of companies will put together a fly tying kit, and everything in that kit is not good stuff. Starting with the tools are usually second to third rate stuff, and the materials they put in there are stuff they can't sell off the wall. That's a good way to unload junk. I'm probably going to get in trouble for saying that.
Well, I don't know that there's many companies who are going to be listening to this podcast, but you never know. AK, thank you so much for taking some time out of your afternoon for me. I really appreciate it. I know everybody at Flying Lures Online is going to really enjoy listening to you chat about a couple of your stories and some of the things that you do. So I really appreciate it. Thank you so
much. Thank you very much. I enjoyed our chat.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me for another FlyAnglersOnline.com podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed this interview as much as I did. It was really a thrill a minute to talk to AK Best. Really appreciate him taking the time out of his day, or his evening actually, to sit and chat with me about a few things fly tying and fly fishing related. I hope you join me soon for another FlyAnglersOnline.com podcast. For this next one, I'm going to see if I can't get one or two of you guys, or three or four, to tell me some fish stories, something good and entertaining, and we'll put it up and all of us can enjoy your experiences. Until then, everyone, tight lines.